Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody down in the U.S. had a very happy Thanksgiving, had some time to spend with your family, and get away from work, your computer, whatever seems to be kind of daily distractions for us all. It was nice to have a bit of a slower week for the markets and even really a day and a half off of trading for a lot of the U.S. markets. That being said, on this weekend show, we're taking a bit more of a big picture look at the markets and at the metals. In the first two segments here, we are joined by Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group, also editor of the Book Report website, which we will link to within this weekend show posting. Peter, as I mentioned, we're focusing on big picture, and big picture concept I think that is the most important right now is what environment we are left with when the Fed and other central banks stop hiking rates. We all know we're getting closer to that period of time. We're not going to guess or analyze when they are going to stop hiking rates. Let's just talk about this environment of when the central banks, especially the Fed, stop hiking rates. What do you think that environment is going to look like, Peter?
Well, historically speaking, when the Fed would be in a rate hiking cycle, they would do so until the U.S. economy went into recession, outside of the rare occasions where they did not, aka soft landing. But historically, it's been mostly a hard landing. And then the Fed immediately pivots to cutting interest rates to cushion the recession. So the question is okay, they're going to hike to call it 4.5%, 5%, whatever. The economy is going to suffer as a result. And does the Fed come to the rescue and start cutting like they have in the past? And I think the problem for the Fed is that higher inflation, even though it is peaking and rolling over, still inflation well above that 1% to 2% rate will sort of handcuff the Fed's ability to cushion any economic weakness. Now, part of that is that's what they want. Bostic, the Atlanta Fed president, recently said that the Fed's going to have to resist the temptation to quickly respond to any pronounced economic weakness if inflation's still remaining very elevated. So what that means is that after they finish hiking, we're going to have to get used to much higher interest rates for a longer period of time than markets are accustomed to. We're not going back to zero anytime soon in the next recession. We're not going to QE so quickly in the next recession. And this higher for longer, because we're so used to saying lower for longer, this higher for longer, tighter for longer is a new environment that is sort of the next mountain to climb for the markets and the economy.
Well, Peter, I think that's an interesting point to raise, because if it's higher for longer for both inflation and higher for longer for interest rates, almost everybody assumes that when the Fed does put in their last few rate hikes and pause, that it means that, as you mentioned, that everybody's expecting them to go back to easing and that there to be recessionary pressures. But what if they pause for a while and then decide, you know what, inflation is still sticky, we may keep hiking? I don't hear anybody discussing that potential that after the pause, they could still do another hike. Is that anything that's on the table in your eyes?
It's very possible. But because of where I see inflation going from here, and that's lower, from what I see where unemployment is going, and that's higher from here, I don't think the Fed has many rate hikes left in it. Now, they could continue on after the next 50 in December, raise a couple more 25s to get to around that 5% level. But I think the economic damage that's being done by this, and it's purposeful, they want to slow the economy, but it's just a question of to what degree. I think in a credit-sensitive, interest rate-sensitive economy, we're going to slow notably. And I don't think the Fed is going to have, as I said, because of that, have too many rate hikes left in it. But that's not necessarily a good thing. That's just a lack of a further negative, because just keeping rates at these high levels, you know, is a squeeze on the economy. I mean, if we're in a new world of 7% mortgage rates in the U.S., even if it stays there for, you know, if it stays there for a couple of years, you know, that puts a freeze on the housing market until either home prices fall enough to offset that, or consumers save up more money for their down payment to lower the size of their loan, which would then lower their monthly payment.
Peter, since you mentioned monthly payment, there's a lot of the people out there that are saying the Fed needs to pivot sooner rather than later. They need to start cutting rates because they can't service their own debt in terms of how much more they need to pay at these higher rates. What's your response to this argument?
Well, that is the problem for those that have adjustable rate / floating rate debt. And their interest expense today is dramatically higher than it was 9 months ago. But, you know, that's sort of the dice roll that people took when they borrowed floating rate and didn't hedge it out, or decided that they liked that lower rate relative to a slightly higher fixed rate. Well, this is the consequence. And if you were managing a business, well, you should have been more careful with how you borrowed. And if you're a household, the same applies. And you know, I feel bad for the pain that this is going to cause, but there were plenty of opportunities for households and businesses to borrow fixed rate for an extended period of time.
Well, Peter, what about the debt load that the Fed holds itself and their ability to service the debt on their balance sheet if rates continue to stay as high as they are, and if they move the terminal rate up to, let's say, close to 5%?
So with respect to that, the Fed, if they were to mark to market their portfolio, they'd have a lot of losses on their balance sheet. But, you know, the Fed is not inclined, at least for treasuries, to sell them. So they think that they'll just hold to maturity and they won't have to deal with the reality of that, even though, you know, there could be accounting issues. There is, though, a reduction in the amount that the Fed will be transferring to the U.S. Treasury, to the point where they'll be making less than what they're paying out to U.S. banks via interest on excess reserves. So if the Fed was treated like a private entity, they would be insolvent. But because it's a government entity, you know, they can do whatever they want, essentially, and not pay a consequence.
Now, when we get to the point where the Fed has paused, what do you think we're going to see on their balance sheet, or any balance sheet movement? Because as high as the balance sheet is, you look back to, I believe it was April, when we saw a peak in where the balance sheet stood, and we are over $300 billion smaller on the balance sheet than the peak.
Right. So the peak was in April at just below $9 trillion. You know, as you said, we're about $340 billion below that, with that continuing. So even if the Fed's almost done hiking, well, they're still shrinking their balance sheet until they stop. But that in itself is a form of monetary tightening, I believe, mostly influential on asset prices rather than directly on the economy. But it still is a form of monetary tightening that will continue on. This is the 2023 challenge, is both the QT and the economic consequences of these very sharp rate increases.
Well, Peter, we also hear the narrative quite often that the Fed has to hike until something breaks. And as you mentioned, in previous cycles, they've hiked until a recession set in. Sometimes they were more mild, other times more elongated. But we've also seen some issues in other sovereign nations and their central banks, like the Bank of England and the Bank of Japan, just to name two, where they did have some issues and had to quickly reverse course to underpin their bond markets or their currencies. Do you think we'll see something like that in the U.S., where the Fed hikes until something dramatic breaks and then they have to come to the rescue? Or is there still any potential they orchestrate a soft landing?
Well, things are already breaking. Ask anybody in crypto whether something's breaking. And you know, that whole industry is breaking. If you look at housing, we've basically stopped the housing market completely in its tracks. I think refis are down almost 90% year over year. New home purchases, or I should say new and existing home purchases, if you look at mortgage applications, are down about 40% year over year. So that's breaking. I think we have to define what break is. Is break a collapse in the banking sector like it was in 08? No, that's not going to happen again. And there's not just one breakage. It can be small breaks that add up to a lot. I'm of the belief that this could be more of a death by a thousand cuts situation rather than, you know, a major accident. It could just be like a 100-car pileup where no one dies, no one is dramatically hurt, but 100 cars just piled up on each other.
Peter, are you blaming crypto, the breakdown, simply on higher rates, though, or was this coming for many other reasons?
Well, these exchanges and the blowups that we're seeing probably would have happened anyway, but on one side of the pendulum, easy money, zero rates, negative rates, QE, creates the foundation at which a lot of these situations are created. And then when the monetary pendulum swings the other way, the fragilities of those business models that survived on zero rates and QE get exposed on higher interest rates and are shown that they never were going to survive anyway, but it's that higher cost of capital and more stringent investor tolerance for risk that then blows them up. And then you get, you know, there'll be phoenixes that rise from the ashes, and the strong that survive will get stronger. And a lot of the flawed business models get exposed. And that's what we see in every bear market and every economic downturn since the history of time.
Well, Peter, to that point, we have seen a lot of the growth stocks, especially the growth tech stocks, roll over pretty hard over the last year, really starting the end of 2021. And it has been exposed that some of the non-revenue generating businesses that had some pretty extreme PE ratios have come back down to earth, found gravity. And there has been a shift in general over to the value sectors, things like healthcare, things like consumer staples. Obviously, energy's had a pretty good year. Do you think that out of the ashes, that the phoenixes that rise will be new leadership, and that it won't be a rush right back into all the same things when the Fed pauses, but actually new companies, or I mean, not new companies, but new sectors that take on the leadership role and strong companies that emerge that are kind of a different playbook than what investors have seen the last dozen years?
If history is any guide, yes, the baton will be passed on to new leadership. That's not to say that Microsoft and Apple and Amazon and Alphabet, to use them, are not great companies with great business models. But in terms of stock market performance, historically speaking, there are new leaders that come about. And I don't see why this won't be any different. And that a lot of these companies are seeing a slower rate of growth, either via the law of large numbers or just a changed economic environment that sees slower growth and multiples that are still elevated relative to those growth rates, and that other parts of the market that did not do well over the years that may have more interesting situations. I mean, just as we saw in the 2000s, you know, the NASDAQ peaked in March 2000 and didn't regain that level until 2013. But there were plenty of stocks that did fine in the 2000s. You know, pre the 08 blow up. And I think that this is going to be a replay, and there'll be other markets that start to outperform. And maybe it's international markets. Maybe now that the Fed is done or almost done raising interest rates, I say almost because they're not there yet, of course, that the dollar rolls over and we start to get better performance overseas relative to the U.S. That's always possible.
What happens to the bond market too, Peter? If the Fed's going to be less active, if they're not cutting rates, where do bonds go?
Well, I think short-term bonds, short maturity bonds, have probably seen the worst of the pain that they're going to have. I'm much less confident on longer duration bonds because of if I were to just analyze, say, U.S. growth and inflation and make my call on the 10-year, to me, that would be pretty straightforward. The 10-year would be attractive because inflation is rolling over and growth is slowing. But I still wonder how long maturity bonds are going to behave if Bank of Japan decides to get off yield curve control, widens that band. What's going to happen with the European bond market as they continue to tighten and they embark on quantitative tightening in the first quarter of next year, that maybe there's more pain to be had in global bond markets as this global bond bubble over the last bunch of years, which is to me the biggest financial bubble in the history of bubbles in terms of size, money-wise, dollar-wise, unwinds. And that I can make the argument for the U.S. 10-year to go to 5%, and I can make the argument for it to go to 3%. And because I'm not just not sure which direction because of those external factors, I'm much more comfortable owning short-duration bonds because I think the Fed's almost done here.
Peter, do you put a lot of stock in the idea that since the yield curve has inverted, a couple of them have inverted, but in particular, the one that Powell was interested in was the 3-month over the 18-month, but we've seen the 2-year over the 10-year, a lot of those inverting, and that tends to be a harbinger of a weaker economy to come. Some people say it's a harbinger of recessions. You know, if we continue to see these patterns play out where the investors are interested more in the short-term bonds, but not so much the long-duration bonds, is that basically people saying they're taking refuge there, they're taking refuge in the dollar, but they don't trust that a strong economic recovery is anywhere close on the horizon?
Yeah, I mean, historically, yes, certainly with this yield curve. But the yield curve is telling us that the U.S. economy does not respond well to ever-rising interest rates, ever-rising short-term interest rates. And it's sending a clear message. But should that surprise people that in a credit interest rate sensitive economy, that the higher the cost of capital it goes, the slower economic growth will be? Because we don't have high savings here in the U.S. The personal savings rate is at its lowest level since 2008 at just 3.1%. We rely on cheap borrowing to generate economic growth. And if borrowing is not so cheap, you're going to have slower growth. It's just the math. If someone's going to go on a hunger strike, well, it can't be the rare instance, well, they're somehow going to live. They need food to survive. Unfortunately, the U.S. economy needs cheap money to survive. Now, it used to be where savings was a big chunk of spending, both on the household side and the corporate side, but it's that reliance on low rates is why it's not a surprise that the yield curve is inverting. And it's inverting to the extent that it is, because the Fed is the most aggressive they've been in 40 years.
It really has been historic how much the Fed has hiked rates throughout this whole year in the face of a lot of people saying they're going to stop. They're going to stop. They have to stop. They've done it the whole year, and it looks like they're going to get into at least early next year. Peter, are investors broadly positioned okay for what sounds like still a relatively tough market as we move into next year?
Well, I can't speak for all investors. I think those investors that think that the worst is over and that when the Fed's done raising interest rates, there's an all clear sign, I disagree with that for reasons that we talked about. I think that while there's going to be amazing opportunities created in 2023, it's still going to be a challenging market and economic environment as long as rates are as high as they are, and for as long as they'll be.
Peter, that brings up another point where we've heard the narrative that when the Fed does finally pause, at least for a while, that there will be this jubilation and that there are a lot of investors on the sidelines or institutions on the sidelines with cash waiting to get back in, waiting for that proverbial all clear. Is it possible we could see a big melt up after the pause and just everything before the rug gets pulled out and we see that next big leg down?
It's very possible. But the question is from what level do we get that melt up? Do we go to 3,500 first and then we rally back to 4,000, which is where we closed today in the S&P 500? It's a question of where that launch pad is from. And we'll just have to see. But for sure, when the Fed says, yeah, we're calling a timeout, yeah, you'll get that relief rally. But then that relief rally opens up to, okay, if rates stay high for a while, is it still safe to go out there and buy things?
Yeah, that's going to be the big question. I think we're all expecting some sort of a bounce or pop when the Fed does fully stop. But again, everyone's expecting that. So how high will it go? How quickly will it turn back over? Peter, what do you think is important to watch then for investors the rest of this year into next year? Again, carried over to the Fed, but also just carried over simply to the markets and the overall health of the markets.
I think a lot will depend on, you know, where inflation goes from here and how quickly does it fall and where does it eventually settle out at. Now, it's going to take time to see where it's going to settle out at, but, you know, each month we're going to get the inflation stats and we can see, you know, how it's progressing and to what extent it's moderating. You know, that'll be important. And well, how the economy sort of progresses in terms of its slowdown from here. When rates go up, it doesn't affect everything immediately and to the same extent. It first affects the interest rate sensitive parts in the economy, like housing and autos. So we know that a rise in mortgage rates has an immediate effect on the housing market. But to the rest of the economy, it doesn't necessarily have an immediate effect. It doesn't have an immediate effect for a business that has fixed debt, but it certainly has, and it has sort of a slow grinding effect on those that have floating rate. You know, up to a point they can manage that, but then you reach a point where it gets tougher and tougher. So it's a progression of events that drive an economic slowdown. It's not just one thing. And we have to see how this progresses as the months and quarters go on from here into 2023.
Peter, I'd also be interested to get your thoughts on the commodity sector, because if we are going to see slowing growth and a potential of recession moving into next year, that seems like that'd be a pretty big headwind towards the commodity sector. And the U.S. dollar has been another headwind that's rolled over recently and helped a little bit. But there's the other component, which is China and the potential reopening of the second largest economy next year. How do you balance that all out with the commodity sector?
Okay, so the demand side is certainly at risk because of China, because of a global recession. But what happens if in March, April, China decides to reopen? Well, that's going to be a lift to demand. But however, which way that demand part of the equation shakes out, we're still facing a very challenged supply side. I think it's hard to argue against the challenged supply side being a major secular bull case to commodities with the ebbs and flows of demand. So until the supply side catches up in a variety of different commodities from a bigger picture, longer term perspective, and money starts piling in to the investment side, I still think commodity prices will be elevated with, again, fits and starts depending on the pace of growth and the demand side. But let's just say we go into a global recession. Are more people going to buy electric vehicles next year than compared to this year? I would think people would still be buying more EVs compared to the year before. And you're talking about, what, 4 to 5 times more copper in an EV compared to an internal combustion engine. Will there be more solar panels in the next couple of years relative to the past couple of years, irrespective of recession? Likely. Well, solar panels use a lot of copper and silver, among other ingredients. So to me, the demand side is still going to go up for some very important commodities. Now, energy may be subject to some demand slippage, but in oil and natural gas, there's not screaming supply out there to tap into. So that could be an offset in why energy prices will probably stay higher for longer.
How does gold fit into this whole equation then?
Well, we know gold has been challenged by the aggressive Fed and other central banks and certainly the strength in the dollar. But, you know, gold's barely down this year. So it's actually done pretty well on a relative basis. And if the Fed's almost done raising interest rates, which I think people are sniffing out, and that's why gold has rallied, and that's causing the weakness in the dollar, which is another reason why gold has rallied. Well, if that becomes reality and the dollar rolls over, then that could be a big lift for gold and silver, and I expect that to happen.
Peter, we also have heard some large publications come out and said gold is no longer a safe haven asset. And when you think about the traditional safe havens, they were things like bonds, which obviously haven't been that safe either. They've underperformed the general markets, one of the first times that's happened in decades. And for some time, people were saying the cryptocurrencies were vying for their safe haven status, and that hasn't worked out too well for those over the last year or so. So where are the safe havens investors can turn to? Is gold still a safe haven?
Well, the only safe haven is cash. It's the only thing that's guaranteed not to lose you money in nominal terms. Obviously, in real terms, it will, but it won't in nominal terms. Gold in real adjusted returns should not, you know, should be a safe haven compared to some other things. But some years it will, some years it won't. I mean, today it's not today. This year it's been a safe haven. It's barely down compared to where most stock markets and, you know, the aggregate bond index is down much more. So it's been a safe haven this year, but it wasn't so much last year. So I guess it's cash is the only safe haven again. I'll repeat that again. And gold sometimes is and sometimes isn't.
Fair enough, Peter. You know what? We're going to leave it there. We've covered a lot here. It really is all about looking ahead to what this environment is going to be like when the central banks stop hiking rates. And I do think we need to understand that rates are going to stay higher for longer. Now, maybe some shock is going to come to the markets that makes the Fed pivot. But overall, the Fed has told us that they most likely are going to leave rates as high as they can for as long as they can. And again, as we saw this year, that can mean a lot longer than a lot of people want to think, especially because everybody just got so used to those low interest rates that just kept on going down. Peter, always great chatting with you. Again, if you want to keep up to date with what Peter is writing and the data that he is watching, you have to check out the Book Report website. Peter, thanks again for taking time with us on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks so much, and I appreciate having me on again.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.